From NPR News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres is accusing the Human Rights Forum meeting in Durban, South Africa, of promoting hatred and anti-Semitism. The Forum of Non-Governmental Organizations is meeting at the same time as a UN conference against racism. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The declaration was adopted by a meeting of 3,000 NGOs that coincides with the United Nations Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. It accuses Israel of, quote, systematic perpetration of racist crimes, including war crimes, acts of genocide, and ethnic cleansing. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres reacted angrily, calling it an outburst of hate, anti-Semitism, and anti-Zionism. Jewish delegates at the meeting walked out in protest. Israeli officials fear a similar declaration will come out of the UN conference in Durban. Israel, the U.S., and Canada sent only junior representatives to Durban to protest what they see as anti-Israel bias. Israel's Haaretz newspaper has reported that Israel is considering leaving the Durban conference if anti-Israel language is included. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Officials in Macedonia say the parliament will resume debate tomorrow on a peace agreement with ethnic Albanian rebels. Yesterday, it suspended talks, saying the rebels were preventing refugees from returning to their homes. More than 100,000 people have been displaced by the fighting. Under a NATO-sponsored agreement, the rebels agreed to turn in their weapons in exchange for increased rights. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is touring the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's hoping that talks with officials there will help to bring an end to the country's civil war. NPR's Ivan Watson reports.
Upon his arrival in the capital, Kinshasa, UN Chief Kofi Annan immediately demanded the withdrawal of all foreign troops from Congolese territory. The diplomats trying to bring an end to what some say is Africa's first world war. Six foreign armies have been fighting in this massive country since the conflict began 3 years ago. An estimated 1 million people have been killed. But fighting's died down over the last year, and there's been new hope for peace since current President Joseph Kabila took over after his father, the former head of state, was assassinated last January. On Monday, Annan's expected to meet with the president of neighboring Rwanda, who has 10,000 soldiers operating in parts of rebel-held Congo. Peace talks between the leaders of Congo's warring factions are to be held in Ethiopia next month. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Dakar, Senegal.
The White House says China will get an update on U.S. missile defense plans before President Bush's planned visit to Beijing next month. Spokesman Ari Fleischer says the United States wants to ease fears that the missile shield poses a threat to China. The Bush administration says the system is simply designed to protect the U.S. This is NPR News. A 10-year-old boy died this morning after being bitten by a shark off the coast of Virginia yesterday. It's the latest of several shark attacks in the waters off southeastern states. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
The shark attack that killed 10-year-old David Peltier occurred at Sand Ridge Beach. It's the first such incident there in 30 years. The shark bit the boy on the leg, which caused severe bleeding. Shark attacks nationally remain most common in Florida. 25 people were bitten here last year, as opposed to one attack that was reported in Virginia, Mexico, and the Bahamas. Florida and Volusia County, east of Orlando, have already broken records with 28 attacks so far this year. 20 of those encounters have occurred off Volusia's popular surfing beaches. Despite the rash of shark attacks, most of that shoreline, including New Smyrna Beach and Ponce Inlet, is open to visitors. Helicopters continue to fly over the waters to keep an eye out for sharks. The most recent attack in Florida was last Thursday, when an Illinois woman was bitten while she was in the water along Coquina Beach on the Gulf of Mexico south of Tampa. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
More than 1,000 firefighters are on the lines battling a forest fire in Montana. The Moose Fire has blackened more than 43,000 acres so far, including some on the western edge of Glacier National Park. Bob McKinney's with the National Forest Service. He says the fire is threatening some structures.
We've got some houses in the line of the fire, and buildings, barns, some commercial buildings. We've got the fire protection units on all of those. We've got sprinkler systems set up, and so far we haven't lost any major structures at all. We lost a couple little outbuildings and a shed and a couple porta potties.
The fire is one of 19 major blazes burning in the West today. I'm Anne Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Freedom Forum, creator of The Newseum, the first interactive museum of news, located in Arlington, Virginia.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, journalists were battling government forces on three fronts. First, it was reported Alabama Senator Richard Shelby plans to reintroduce an anti-leak measure that President Clinton vetoed last fall. The proposed law has been dubbed an Official Secrets Act. Journalist groups predict that a flood of subpoenas demanding leakers' names would follow the passage of the measure, that it would all but crush the media's ability to serve as government watchdog.
Second, the Justice Department subpoenaed the phone records of AP reporter John Solomon. It wants to learn which federal officials leaked to Solomon the contents of an FBI wiretap of Senator Robert Torricelli, who was under investigation for illegal fundraising. Critics say issuing a subpoena in this case is not only banned under department guidelines, it's unconstitutional. And yet another case, novice crime writer Vanessa Leggett was investigating a society murder when she interviewed the alleged trigger man, later found dead in his cell. Federal prosecutors demanded her notes. She refused, and now she's serving 18 months for contempt. Lucy Dalglish, head of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, is here to guide us through these events. Welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
Why did the Justice Department want Solomon's phone records?
They apparently believe that someone within the Justice Department has been leaking to John Solomon about this wiretap.
How serious is it to go after a reporter's phone records?
It's virtually unheard of. The last time we're really aware of was a period of time from 1971 until 1974 when the Nixon administration went after about a half a dozen reporters' phone records.
And what about the Justice Department's guidelines?
The guidelines call for a very explicit inquiry to be followed and for there to be a determination that there's no alternative way to identify the information that they're seeking. And obviously, they know who had access to this information, and they could have gone after the people they know had access to it rather than trying to figure out who John Solomon had been talking to.
This subpoena of John Solomon's phone records comes only a couple of weeks after the Justice Department had Vanessa Leggett imprisoned in Houston, where she still sits, evidently, for withholding her notes from a grand jury. They wanted information on her interview with the alleged trigger man, but that isn't all they wanted?
The subpoena was really very broad. It asked for all of her materials in connection with the book that she's trying to write. But it specifically lists 34 people that they want all information she has about her conversations with those 34 people. And a large percentage of those people are state and federal prosecutors, state and federal law enforcement investigators, and defense attorneys. So they're quite obviously trying to figure out who within their own investigation has been leaking information to her. By next Wednesday, Vanessa Leggett will have served a jail sentence for contempt longer than any other reporter in American history that we can find out. It'll be 46 days next Wednesday.
Do you see any patterns emerging on the Justice Department's view of freedom of the press under the Bush administration?
Well, a week ago I would have said no. This week I'd have to say it's becoming pretty apparent that there's a new tone at the Justice Department, and that is that they will try to identify leakers at any cost.
You were mentioning that this is a bad week. This week it was also reported that Senator Richard Shelby, he's a Republican from Alabama, has a plan to reintroduce what's been called an Official Secrets Act. It's an anti-leak legislation that President Clinton had vetoed last fall. This coming week, there's supposed to be one day of testimony on it, which the news organizations want to push off so they have time to prepare. But what would this anti-leak provision of Senator Shelby's do?
It would make it a crime for the leaker or anyone within government to disclose national security information or information that is, quote, properly classified. It would make it a crime, therefore, for whistleblowers to talk to the media. And the result would undeniably lead to an increase in the number of subpoenas served upon the media, because the only way you're going to really be able to figure out who the leakers are is if you subpoena the journalist.
Do you think the current administration is likely to veto the bill if it passes this time around?
I don't think that's likely. That's why it's very important to get this thing stopped before it leaves Congress.
So, Lucy Dalglish, what is your mood these days with regard to the First Amendment and press freedom?
I'm so exhausted. Everybody has been telling me that August is so slow in Washington and that, you know, you should be able to just cruise through it. But I have to tell you that I have never been busier in my life. I just can't get over this chilling effect. I've heard some old-timers from the journalism world here in Washington describe this to me as almost a Nixonian atmosphere and how the media is feeling put upon with these subpoenas.
What's the solution, if not another Watergate?
I think what we're going to have is a situation where a very important story breaks and it comes about because some classified information is leaked and the public is able to comprehend the important role that the media plays in our society.
So you want another Pentagon Papers?
I think the Pentagon Papers case did an enormous world of good to the journalism world and did the public a great service also.
So leakers everywhere, heed Lucy Dalglish's call.
I'm not saying you have to give it to me.
Lucy Dalglish, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Lucy Dalglish is the executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press.
Everyone here at On the Media is media aware, of course, except for producer-at-large Mike Pesca, who is media compulsive, constantly stuffing his pockets with scraps gathered here and there. Periodically, we like to go through Mike's pockets. Mike, disgorge for us.
Okay, first item I have here is David Broder, who's the columnist for The Washington Post, and he wrote a column this week called Jesse Helms, White Racist. Broder criticizes the media for its coverage of Jesse Helms' retirement announcement. Here's Broder. The reporting on his retirement was circumspect to the point of pussyfooting.
That's unusual in the first instance because Broder himself has been accused often enough of being, well, let's just say, extremely even-handed in his column writing, not exactly a raver.
Right. But to Broder's taste, any recapitulation of the career of Jesse Helms is insufficient unless it has the word racist or bigot right up there in the first sentence. However, I think his media criticism is a little off base. The New York Times editorial said that few senators in the modern era have done more to buck the tide of progress and enlightenment than Mr. Helms. That's hardly pussyfooting.
There was one major newspaper, though, that did sort of soft pedal Jesse Helms' record of race baiting over the years. What newspaper was that?
That would be the Washington Post. And Broder himself notes that. They wrote about him in really the political context. They wrote about how important he is to fundraising, how important he was to the Conservative Party. Of all the coverage I read, the one where they really seem to strike a balance, and I would argue a phony balance between was he a racist or wasn't he a racist, was the Washington Post.
Okay. Racial controversy. NAACP President Kwesi Mfume was criticized recently. Give us the background.
As president of the NAACP, Mr. Mfume criticized the networks for being bad in their minority hiring practices. It came out that he himself was, quote, shopping around a network television show. This was a story that was first broken in the LA Times, and it played out in some other papers, and by this week, Mfume was saying, all right, I'm not going to aggressively try to have this television show.
All right. Now, eyebrows were raised because it looks like maybe some sort of shakedown. You complain about not enough black faces, and lo and behold, you're putting your own name up for nomination. But why shouldn't eyebrows have been raised to begin with?
If Infume's point is that there should be more minorities on the air, why not put on the air a former United States congressman who's a very effective communicator and could get attention paid to himself? And the man I'm describing is Kwesi Mfume. He's all those things. However, a lot of things need to be pointed out. One, he's hosted a show in Baltimore for many, many years. So his supposed pilot was more of an offshoot of the show he was hosting than any sort of new effort. Secondly, the whole story came about because the LA Times story had a few factual errors. For instance, it said that the show he's been hosting in Baltimore was actually out of Boston. That's untrue. That got repeated a couple times. But it also had a quote like this. While the show is generating quiet criticism from the black creative community, leaders of other minority groups expressed little concern. It doesn't do anything to back up this quiet criticism. I think it very irresponsibly raises a specter of quiet criticism without saying where the criticism came from. And when you get to the point of actually criticizing what Mfume was doing, it doesn't really hold up in terms of him doing anything that approached blackmail.
All right, now to Chicago. The pendulum has swung, right?
It certainly has. WBBM, Chicago's news laggard, was experiencing ratings doldrums, as you might recall, a few years ago. One of the things they tried to do was to go serious with their news, bring back the old Huntley-Brinkley era. They hired Carol Marine, who was a respected anchor person in the field, and the experiment failed miserably.
The theory was they had nothing to lose by going to hard news, but their ratings sank even farther.
Right, so maybe that little bit of self-discovery was worth it to them. But now, in a complete 180, WBBM Channel 2 management invited to the station and are wooing a person by the name of Jennifer Santiago. Are you familiar with her work?
I'm not.
She does the weather on a CBS-owned station in Miami, but you also might know her as Jennifer Klarman. Familiar with that name at all, Bob?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer Klarman, who posed topless for Playboy in their Voluptuous Vixens pictorial.
And do we know what her turn-ons are?
Yeah, turn-ons are long walks on the beach, champagne, and the Doppler radar 2000.
How about turn-offs?
Yeah, she doesn't like mean people or freedom of information filings, which take over 2 weeks.
All right, Mike, thank you for emptying your pockets.
A pleasure.
Mike Pesca is On the Media's producer at large.
After 34 years, Mr. Rogers finally left the neighborhood. He was so slow, so gray, so drab, so utterly unintelligent. How could he have lasted so long? I'll tell you why. He spoke up for the little guys. I mean literally, the little guys. The ones who stand adored but distrusted, confused and squinting in the long shadow of grown-ups. Mr. Rogers was little, too, about a foot or so high on the average TV screen. He shambled and sang and looked directly into the eyes of children year after year, and all he ever really said was that everything was going to be okay. I could give you the names of a lot of adults, diminished by joblessness or drugs or loneliness, who found genuine consolation in the laughably sincere assurances of Mr. Rogers. It was his own little miracle that he could penetrate that impersonal medium, reach through the glass, and serve up daily a child-sized portion of peace.
I hope that you'll remember, even when you're feeling blue, that it's you I like, it's you yourself, it's you, it's you I like.
Coming up, the victory of Lifetime Television and the reinvigoration of Reader's Digest.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Well, the summer's winding down and the bean counters in TV land are counting up the winners and losers. The winner, according to Variety, is cable, which beat the six broadcast networks decisively in the ratings. And one of the biggest winners in basic cable, the service that snagged the number one spot in prime time, is not MTV, not CNN, not Fox News, and not Nickelodeon. It's Lifetime. Television for Women. We're joined now by Max Robbins, columnist for TV Guide. So, Max, what happened in the last 2 years to catapult Lifetime to the number one spot?
You really can look at Lifetime's really startling growth in a mature business. to Carol Black coming aboard as the president. And what she really did was solidify the Lifetime brand and expand on it and launched a number of new series, most of which have been successful. They upped their production of original movies, and they got much more aggressive in marketing the brand. They also, in a real dollars and cents term, said, we're going to spend some more money. In the last couple of years, their budget for original programming, from what I understand, has gone from $100 million to $200 million. It's paid off.
Who is the audience for Lifetime?
Well, it's primarily women, say probably 60-65% women. But there are a lot of men who watch as well. And I think it has a real middle America appeal, which isn't to say it's not sophisticated. It's a place that says, here, you can come here to be entertained and informed. But it's not work to come here.
There was another effort to launch a kind of women's service. That was Oxygen.
That's started by Jerry Laybourne, who founded Nickelodeon and is kind of a legendary figure in television programming. And she, in launching this, almost was kind of looking down her nose at Lifetime, almost like this was, you know, the Kmart women's network. And I really don't think that's fair. I think there was a kind of an intellectual snobbery there. And I think that she was trying to program a network to women who don't watch a lot of television.
So it seems that programming television for women who don't watch television isn't likely to be a winning strategy.
No, look, you have to go out there and say, okay, who's the audience that's interested? And how are they? Are they underserved? And what are they like? Can I give them more of it? And I think that that's what Lifetime did.
What do you say to those women, then, who dismiss Lifetime as the network of victims and domestic workers and people in extremity and all the sturm and drang that never seems to end?
Well, I think that's too facile an analysis. I mean, you look at a show like Any Day Now that traces the relationship between a white woman and an African-American woman and chases their friendship that goes back to girlhood in the South. It's a very intelligent, well-written, well-acted show. And if you're going to just dismiss this whole network out of hand like that, you might be cheating yourself out of a valuable television viewing experience. A funny story that one of the creators of that show told me, she said she pitched that several years ago to one of the broadcast networks. I believe it was CBS. And they said, you know, she sat with the executives and they said, it's a terrific idea. We just want you to make one little change. Make the two leads men instead of women. And I think that pretty much sums it up here. I mean, what's going on and what Lifetime's appeal is.
Do you watch Lifetime?
I've been known to watch it. I like The District. I like a good cop show.
And it's okay if the crusty old police captain is a woman?
Let's put it this way. She's a lot less crusty than looking at Dennis France on NYPD Blue.
J. Max Robbins, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke. Always a pleasure.
Max Robbins writes The Robbins Report for TV Guide.
Some viewers regard Lifetime the way they might a pint of Häagen-Dazs. Tasty, but a little too sweet, and likely to leave you feeling a little queasy if you consume too much. Reporter Sarah Montague, it's fair to say, is one of those viewers, and she decided to get to the bottom of the network's appeal.
Surely they've caught your eye as you flip through your television guide. Of course you were on your way to Frontline, but didn't you linger for just a moment on A Deadly Silence, or Shattered Trust, or Dangerous Child? Behind these portentous titles are some of the over 125 movies Lifetime Television presents each year. According to Dawn Tarnowski-Ostroff, executive vice president of Lifetime Entertainment, they live up to the commitment implicit in the network's bold branding slogan.
Lifetime. Television for women.
Television for women means a place where women come to be informed, entertained, and supported.
Lifetime's films fall into two categories, acquired works and 12 original movies, productions that Lifetime funds and aggressively promotes. These tend to be inspirational and cause-related, while the acquired movies run a predictable gamut, improbable love stories, tabloid-based domestic dramas, and damsel-in-distress thrillers.
Can one man's love heal a lifetime of hurt?
You took my family away from me. I'll never forgive you for that.
Abusive men, dysfunctional children, and noble invalids abound. Are such offerings at odds with Lifetime's declared mission to sustain and celebrate women? Not according to Tarnowski-Ostroff.
We do research all across the country, and what we hear over and over and over again is that women really find our movies inspiring, and they don't really see any of these movies as women who are victimized. They see women who are heroines, and it feels very empowering to them.
For me, this combination of escapism and uplift makes Lifetime a great guilty pleasure, like chocolate bodice rippers and back issues of People magazine. And I'm not alone in my ambivalence, as an informal survey among women in my office revealed.
Well, my appeal for watching Lifetime is to find the story behind the story.
I'll stick to Comedy Central.
I found it to be insipid, insulting, and badly acted.
It's just a way to waste Sundays.
It's why you want to watch TV, because you want to see the white principal falling in love with the Mexican janitor and it working out as this excellent romance.
We choose our Lifetime original films by first looking for films that are about ordinary women in extraordinary situations.
Lifetime's Tarnovsky Ostrov.
I think women like to get emotionally involved in a good story.
Of course, good is a subjective word, and novelist Susan Isaacs, author of the salty essay Great Dames and Wimpettes, thinks contemporary media offers few good heroines.
Where are all those wonderful roles played by Rosalind Russell and Betty Davis, the strong women that we admired? There was movie after movie really praising victimhood.
It's as if every viewer at home could say, what would I do if I were in that situation?
Dawn Tarnowski-Ostrov.
We really are more than just a television network. We're out in the field. We really try to connect with women and be in their lives for the causes that are important to them.
Real-life issues were the basis of several recent Lifetime original movies, including What Makes a Family, starring Brooke Shields and Cherry Jones as lesbian parents, and Within These Walls, with Ellen Burstyn as a hardened criminal whose humanity is restored through a dog training program run by a Dominican nun played by Laura Dern.
There was a point in my life, for several years, where I couldn't even talk to anybody face to face. That felt like a prison.
They're not gonna let me out of this one anymore.
You can still be free.
I know that if I had a busy day at work and I was a mother and a wife and I'd fed the kids, I'm not sure then that in my leisure time I want to sit down and watch a movie for 2 hours and get thoroughly depressed and at the end of it feel there's no hope.
Trevor Walton, Lifetime Senior Vice President of Original Movies, feels that offering hope is part of the network's job.
We are a very, very frightened group, I think, especially in America. And I love the idea of making programs that show you that through all of that clutter of all the fear and headlines, that people are just as extraordinary and optimistic and capable of controlling their destinies as they ever were.
For Tarnovsky Ostrov, network is sisterhood.
We're busy running in our own little lane of life, doing as much as we can, as fast as we can, and it's seldom that we really have the chance to connect with another woman. And I think a place like Lifetime is a sanctuary for women.
But Susan Isaac sees this particular sanctuary as confining.
I have nothing against Lifetime, but what bothers me is that their vision of what women are seems to be very narrow, domestic. Happiness is, you know, a warm, cuddly child and a large, hairy dog. And women are spunky and women are feisty, but women are never brave. And women never fight for any ideas that don't arise out of being mom, dog owner, and sometimes wife.
We would be such great parents, Neen. Sandy, please. I want a child.
Lifetime has taken on controversial subjects, often linked to its public affairs initiatives, including gay parenting, military cover-ups, and human cloning, yet almost all are examined in this context of domestic life. Isaacs believes it is the obligation of art to demand more.
Women are heroic when they risk their lives or their safety for something larger than themselves.
There is no place on Lifetime for the magnificent wrong-headedness of an Antigone or a Medea. Like a roller coaster, its films follow a careful track, which after it curves and plunges, deposits you safely on the same ground from which you started. So, at the weekend, I plan to open a box of chocolates and settle in with this consoling, conscientious network. But I'll find time, too, for those disconcerting worlds, those disconcerting women, who remain stubbornly outside the frame. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Montague.
The Accident, a Moment of Truth movie. Next, on Lifetime.
Reader's Digest, with 12.6 million subscribers, has the largest paid circulation of any magazine in the country. Now it's getting a new editor, Jackie Leo, formerly editor of Family Circle magazine and former editorial director of Good Morning America, will be taking over Reader's Digest in October. Jackie, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob.
What's your mandate in taking over Reader's Digest?
Well, essentially, to bring in the baby boom generation and maintain our association with the older readers, to make sure that people understand that this is a very relevant magazine at a time when there's so much media out there, that having a small, short read, kind of America in your pocket, is a very smart thing to do.
You mentioned the older readers. Mm-hmm. The average subscriber to Reader's Digest has been dead for 11 years. Don't you have a
That's an interesting statistic.
Older skewing audience?
No, this is not any different than a large, very mass audience. The same probably is true of a lot of television shows, including evening news programming. When you have that many people doing anything, you're going to be losing people on the back end all the time.
What is it like to be Reader's Digest in a Jerry Seinfeld, Sex and the City world?
Well, I love it. There are two things about Reader's Digest that I think are very compelling. One is that it's a short, smart digest of America, meaning that you're going to get a snapshot of the trends and the relevant ideas that are circulating in this country in any given issue. The second thing is that it's very optimistic, and I think that in itself bridges the generations across the board.
Frankly, that's the aspect of the magazine that makes it just completely unreadable for me. I find its optimism oppressive.
You know, you can say the same thing about Oprah's enormously successful magazine, O. I mean, if anything is optimistic, it would be a magazine like that. I think that there is a real reason to think quite positively without being self-delusional about what's going on.
Or Pollyanna.
Exactly. I don't think it's like, gee whiz, this is an audience that's mature. They've certainly seen war and strife, and they've seen economic good and bad. And I think at the end of the day, I personally would rather come out on the upside, that the glass is still half full. And I think a lot of our readers would agree with that.
Jackie?
So, yeah?
Please put your right hand in the air.
Yes. Am I swearing on something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Reader's Digest.
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been a subscriber?
I don't subscribe, but I have picked it up on the newsstand from time to time, especially since they redesigned the covers.
Is there one thing that you really love about the magazine that will survive no matter what during your regime?
The humor it really is quite funny, and I think you should, if you haven't seen it, you should take a look at some of the laugh lines that are submitted.
Oh, like I don't go to the doctors. Of course I see it.
So there's that. But I want to bring back something that I haven't seen in the last few issues, which is the most unforgettable character. I think that was a real winner for years and years, and I think it's wonderful to profile odd and eccentric folks who are doing interesting things.
But in general, we're speaking of evolutionary changes and not tearing the thing up and starting.
Oh, absolutely. All over. I don't believe in radical change. I've been at too many mass publications, and you cannot do that to people. It's annoying, it's disrespectful, and it may not work. Does it mean that you never evolve and change? Of course not. Of course you're going to introduce new columns. I anticipate a trends column, for example. I think this generation wants to know what's happening, what the latest catchphrases are, what's cool, what isn't. Are baseball hats worn backwards over? I don't know, you know.
I have this vague recollection of first-person stories by body parts. Kevin the Kidney, Sophie the Sphincter, this sort of thing.
I know.
Are you going to see them coming back?
My body, myself, I don't think so. But if they are, they're going to come back in a very animated form, I suspect.
Horatio the hypothalamus. That's right. That's very big potential.
Listen, if it's a way of educating people about their bodies, why not?
All right. Well, Jackie Leo, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Jackie Leo is the editor-designate for Reader's Digest magazine.
Careful listeners to the previous interview may have heard Jackie Leo invoke the phrase, the end of the day. The end of the day has had a solid run in the media lately. That's why we've taken it on at the end of the summer in our regular series called Word Watch. OTM's Tony Macillas reports.
The phrase, at the end of the day, is the Queen's English, literally. Queen Elizabeth II used it at the opening of a government building in 1982. In fact, it was a cliché as early as 1974, according to Evan Morris, the web's word detective and a nationally syndicated columnist.
Sort of overwhelmed the media over there, and everyone was saying at the end of the day, meaning sort of what we meant a few years ago when we would say the bottom line is.
Eventually, in the final analysis, when all is said and done, that's what at the end of the day means in the imprecise sense.
Universal time, 16 hours, 33 minutes, 55 seconds.
But there's no room for imprecision on Dr. Dennis McCarthy's watch.
My title is the director of the Directorate of Time.
5 seconds.
Dr. McCarthy is the arbiter of time for the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. Congress made the observatory the official timekeeper for the country, and Dr. McCarthy oversees the master clock. In his world, the end of the day has a very specific meaning.
It's the time which is actually related to the mean solar time along the meridian of Greenwich. So the day there begins at 0 hours, 0 minutes, and 0 seconds, coordinated universal time, and would end, of course, with 23 hours, 59 minutes, and 59 seconds, coordinated universal time.
Coordinated universal time is Greenwich Mean Time. So it seems England is responsible for both the literal and figurative meanings of at the end of the day. But a musical based on Victor Hugo's epic novel spread the cliché to the USA.
The specific trigger may have been the musical Les Miserables, which actually has a song in it called At the End of the Day.
At the end of the day, you're another day older.
The word detective says that the opening of the hit musical coincides perfectly with a sudden fourfold rise in the usage of At the End of the Day. The song comes early in the first act of one of the longest plays on Broadway. Not longest running, literally the longest. With three acts and nearly 3 hours of music, The End of the Day isn't close to the end of the play. In New York, I'm Tony Macillas for On the Media.
Coming up, our back-to-school special, One Teenager's Media Diet, how the government influenced the media diet of teenagers across the country, and why students are leaving their school papers for the web.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Almost a year ago, reporter Dan Forbes revealed on Salon.com that a government program designed to place anti-drug messages in the media was influencing scripts of network dramas and sitcoms. Now Forbes discovers that despite specific congressional prescriptions, the White House anti-drug office is influencing news programming as well on the in-school cable network called Channel One. Dan Forbes, welcome to OTM.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
The idea of the government ad credit program was they were going to give a bonanza in ad purchases to various media, but the quid pro quo from the media is for every ad the government bought, the medium had to provide a second ad at no cost.
Yeah, that actually was mandated by Congress when they appropriated $1 billion in ad buys over the course of 5 years.
But there was a loophole for the media. If they didn't want to give away an ad for free, they were able to get credit through their programming itself. Is that right?
That's correct. There were financial credits for the correct anti-drug content.
Give me an example of what kind of programming was credited towards the free ad.
Television networks, five of six of them, received some $22 million in financial credits for inserting anti-drug messages in the most popular shows on TV, ER, Drew Carey, Beverly Hills, 90210, etc. And six national magazines, including U.S. News World Report, The Sporting News, 17, submitted articles for credit that would free up advertising they owed the government.
So now, on the heels of the revelations about the magazines, you discover that, among other news organizations, Channel One has been getting credit for its news programming that airs in the nation's high schools. And this news is precisely where Channel One put its anti-drug messages. Why don't we listen to an excerpt from one of those stories?
And Gotham joins us now to wrap up this special report on heroin. Gotham?
Thanks, Miriam. Yesterday, we introduced you to Sarah, a recovering heroin addict. When Sarah was still buying heroin, she was helping to finance a large illegal operation, heroin trafficking. It's heroin users who demand the drug and fuel the supply. Today, in part two of our series, Heroin on the Street, we take a look at the efforts to choke off that supply. The supply, experts say, is now more available than ever.
All right, well, that seems straightforward enough. It's a story about heroin trafficking that portrays heroin trafficking as destructive for individuals and for the society. Most news organizations have a firewall between the editorial and business sides. If an article appears in a newspaper or a story appears on Channel One with an implicit anti-drug message, and if someone in ad sales decides to submit it for credit, where's the harm in that?
We can answer that question by the fact that in the first half of this past school year, Channel One succeeded only one time out of 10 in getting financial credits. In the second half, they succeeded seven times out of 11. Essentially, a White House law enforcement operation is helping to shape their editorial focus.
So let me see if I've got this right. During the first half of the year, Channel One did a number of stories that it deemed possibly eligible, submitted them to the drug office, and the drug office turned most of them down, saying no, for this reason, for that reason, it doesn't match our checklist of points that we want to see covered. In the second half of the year, freshly informed of what the drug office regarded as a salient anti-drug information, they submitted another batch of stories which just happened to conform with the drug office's checklist. Is that how it worked?
Checklist, the drug office refers to them as message platforms, actually. And it's interesting. The first half of the year, they had news segments on issues such as the death penalty or the civil war in Colombia.
Now, what is it about the Colombia drug war that was deemed insufficiently cautionary by the White House drug office?
Well, their contractor, in an evaluation that I was able to obtain, said, quote, "No relevant message platform suggests that the involvement of U.S. military may be too extensive and may eventually result in the deployment of American troops as in Vietnam." It was interesting as well regarding her rejection of a death penalty story, if you'd like to hear the evaluation of that.
Yeah, what did they have to say?
Contains a tangential and mixed message, focuses on the problems with the death penalty, and states that sentencing is unjust and often based on race and economic status. It also says, states that the person on death row who was interviewed did commit a murder as a teenager to obtain drug money, but there is no indication that his murderous act was caused by a drug-induced state. The link to drugs is, in fact, very weak. So, remarkably enough, although he's on death row because he committed murder to obtain drug money, that was not a sufficiently direct link to drugs.
I'm just dying to know, what did the government deem a successful message platform in the second half of the year that the drug murders were insufficient to meet in the first?
Well, it's not rocket science. You get feedback from the government evaluator communicated through the government's ad agency, Ogilvy & Mather, and they say, boom, we want to focus on negative consequences.
It seems faintly less damning because it's for a good cause, but I guess it's alarming nonetheless.
Well, when I spoke to folks previously about this, there was some talk among ONDCP contractors that if this paradigm works with anti-drug messages, why stop there? Why not approach issues of sexual mores, abortion, immigration, that the sky's the limit?
All right. Dan Forbes, thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
Dan Forbes wrote about the Office of Drug Policy for Salon.com.
Forces in Washington are affecting not just what students see, but what they can say, so much so that increasingly they are forsaking their school papers and taking to the Internet. The Student Press Law Center in Arlington, Virginia, recently published a cyber guide to advise young journalists on their rights and responsibilities online. When it comes to print, the laws are clear. In 1988, the Supreme Court ruled in the matter of Hazelwood versus Crowmeyer that school officials can censor any school-sponsored material as long as there's, quote, a reasonable educational justification. On the Media's Alicia Zuckerman explains.
The Hazelwood decision defines reasonable educational justification so broadly that it actually allows material to be censored if it's grammatically incorrect.
You know, and in many ways, the growth of websites and online expression has occurred because of Hazelwood.
Mike Heastand is the Student Press Law Center staff attorney.
We believe that the First Amendment should really have no age limit. And when they're away from school and on their own time and using their own resources, students should have the same right to speak their mind and have their voices heard as any other citizen.
On the Internet, freedom of expression isn't limited to students with good grammar or those who can afford their own printing presses. Last spring in Illinois, young journalists at Hinsdale Central High spoke their minds and ran smack into Hazelwood. They had devoted an issue of their award-winning newspaper, The Devil's Advocate, to school violence. The cover depicted a faceless student with a gun coming out of a television. Before the papers hit the hallways, Principal James Ferguson gave the editorial staff an ultimatum. 17-year-old Annie Gilsdorf, now the paper's editor-in-chief, was the project's lead writer.
The demands included removing all the illustrations which accompanied the story, including the cover photo, removing a sidebar to the piece, which was a comparison of our school and Columbine High School in Columbine, Colorado, and changing the title of a sidebar called Getting a Gun, which was about gun laws in Illinois and the availability of guns to young people.
The students decided not to comply with Ferguson's demands, and the papers were destroyed.
But we felt that we still had a powerful story to tell, and that was it was important for the students to read the story, even more so following the censorship of the issue.
So they did what any enterprising young people of the 21st century would do. Informed of their rights by the Student Press Law Center and the American Civil Liberties Union, they took it to the web.
The web made it very easy for us to get the story out there and allow people to see the information.
Hinsdale Principal James Ferguson turned down several requests from On the Media for an interview. He did tell the Chicago Tribune last spring that he based his decision on a fundamental issue of school safety and that he objected to the tabloid style of the photos and illustrations. But by all accounts, Ferguson didn't have a history of interfering with editorial decisions. Attorney Mike Heastand.
I think what made this, you know, all the more troublesome for the students at Hinsdale, because they knew that they did good work, and they knew what it was like to enjoy press freedom.
About the time the Devil's Advocate school violence issue was pulled, a high school sophomore in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, was bypassing print and school journalism altogether. Conrad Flynn and a few friends launched an independent web publication called The Babbitt, covering their school and community. It had been up for less than a year when they scooped the local papers on a story about a group of teenagers passing counterfeit money around town.
We ran that story on a Friday afternoon, immediately after we got home from school, 2 days before any other area publication was on it. I mean commercial publications also.
Flynn says being both inside the school and online gave the Babbitt the edge. The same freedom that allows civic-minded students to get out from under the thumb of their schools is bound to appeal to kids with more sinister goals. In a Dallas suburb, one teenager used an online message board to urge a student suffering from multiple sclerosis to commit suicide unless the disease killed her first. And last spring, a website called Interschool Hoes invited students to vote on who they thought were their most promiscuous classmates at elite New York City private schools. Students' names and schools were posted, as well as their supposed sexual exploits, in rather graphic detail.
That particular website was the 21st century version of graffiti on a bathroom wall.
Susan Feibelman is the head of upper schools at the Packer Collegiate Institute in Brooklyn, one of the schools named on the Interschool Hose website. Next year, all Packer students in grades 5 through 12 will get laptop computers, which they'll have with them day and night.
What's scary as a parent, while other behaviors like drinking, we've had experiences with that behavior ourselves, so we can make some predictions about what are the signs that we need to look for. What's happening with technology is children are light years ahead of their parents.
And when it comes to cyber graffiti, schools have no jurisdiction unless it's done on school property or time. Ultimately, says Packer's head of school, Jeff Pearson, this isn't an issue about technology. It's an issue about behavior.
The reality is that what happens off campus affects what happens on campus. Now, we can't discipline a student officially, but we can certainly make our opinion felt. We can talk to parents, we can talk to children, and we can raise the issue. So I don't think in that sense it's new.
What are the limits of free speech in a school community?
Susan Feibelman.
I think healthy school communities have that dialogue daily. So what it means is sometimes we're really uncomfortable.
Attorney Mike Heaston of the Student Press Law Center says it's important for students to learn that with freedom comes responsibility. But he adds it's equally important for schools to understand that the First Amendment is not optional. For On the Media in New York, I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
In our desire to plumb the depths of the young among us, we asked a teenager to carry around a tape recorder to track her media consumption on a typical day this week. So, ladies and gentlemen, here for your delectation is the media diet of 16-year-old Janice Nieves of the South Bronx, beginning with the moment she opens her eyes.
I hate that buzzer. I really do. So I turn it off as soon as I wake up and leave the radio on.
I always sleep with the radio. I can't sleep without it for some reason.
Up next on Hot 97.
I turn to Hot 97's morning show with Star and Buck Wild. Star calls himself a hater, but he just speaks his mind about everyone. That's all.
I went on a date with somebody, called him up a week later, and he says, well, who's this? I said, Star. Call me a beautiful daughter. She said, you mean my 16-year-old daughter? I said, whoa! Whoa!
You know, I'm trying to be like that, especially in school. Like, not caring what anybody think, not being afraid to sit in class or raise your hand and say something when you want to say it, even if it sounds stupid. But then, you know, sometimes he does go overboard.
Anyway, folks, coming up at 7:20, I have a sincere apology in regards to Aaliyah.
Let me tell you, on Monday, after Aaliyah died, you know, that singer and actress who was killed in a plane crash, Star played these special effects, right? Sounds of a woman screaming while a plane goes down. It crashed, and then you didn't hear anything. After that, his co-host walked out on him, and I don't blame her. Then he actually played it again. As one of her fans, I was mad as hell. But the next day, he apologized.
Yeah, I can apologize to Aaliyah's family and her friends, and your Hot 97 listeners. Sure, I can apologize. That's nothing that's beyond me.
I accepted his apology. And anyway, my last memory of Aaliyah won't be a sound effect. It'll be her music. I remember when that song came out. I kept playing it over and over again. I used to get in front of the mirror and make believe I was one of her dancers. She was real smooth. She made me feel like I didn't have to try hard. I could just be me. Cartoon time! In the summer, I watched all the cartoons I missed during the school year, like Rugrats. You're so cute.
Angelica!
Oh, hello, Daddy.
Angelica, didn't Daddy specifically explain to you about 100 times how important these papers are?
Yes, Daddy. I'm so sorry. I'll never do it again.
After a while, though, cartoons get boring. And I start to realize, unlike the Rugrats, I'm getting older. And I can't get away with everything. On the number 5 express train into Manhattan, if you don't have music or something to read, you look up and see all these ads. This is one that always seems to catch my eye. It says, Fast Track to Who You Want to Be. And it shows all these college graduates. That's going to be me one day. When I get home, the PlayStation is always on. I've got to remind my brother that he needs a life. I go and see if my mother has the newspaper.
Do you have the paper? You didn't buy the paper? What's going on?
Anyway, at least there's always the internet. The internet is one place I know I can count on to get the story on what's up with the world.
Fans remember Aaliyah, 22-year-old R&B singer killed in a plane crash.
It's also fun to surf the net and check things out. I like to go to a site called diamondsforever.com, where you can customize your own engagement rings. How fat is that? I'm not engaged or anything. I just like to imagine all the diamonds I'll have in the future.
Me.
Then I go to a website called ontheline.org. It's where I go to speak my mind about different topics. Like that song, Because I Got High by Afro Man.
I was gonna clean my room until I got high. I was gonna get up and find the broom, but then I got high.
Some people think the song encourages teens to get high. I don't think so. I think he's trying to say not to.
I messed up my entire life because I got high.
Look what he lost by getting high.
I lost my kids and wife because I got high.
Say what, say what, say what, say what.
Lying in my bed, listening to the radio. I'm by myself. But I feel like people are listening to my thoughts. Somehow, everything seems meant for me. Star of Hot 97 knows I hate that buzzer. So he comes on to make me laugh. When Afro Man sings, I feel like he knows that my father was a drug addict. And when Aaliyah says, if at first you don't succeed, dust yourself off and try again. It makes me think about the 2 years I wasted not going to high school. I'm going back this fall to try again. People are always asking, are we alone in this world? I think not. For On the Media in the Bronx, I'm Janice Nieves.
Dust yourself off and try again. You can dust it off and try again, try again. Because if at first you don't succeed, you can dust it off and try again. Dust yourself off and try again, try again.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Melissa Sanford, engineered by Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. Janice Nieves' Media Diet piece was produced by Marianne McCune. We had help from Dylan Keefe and Sean Landis. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media was brought to you by the Bidell Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.